Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker. Today's podcast is Warfighting: Generating Readiness in a Nuclear Environment. We welcome Major General retired Brad Gehrke. Prior to retirement from active duty, Major General Gehrke served as the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff, U.S. Army, as the Director of Strategy, Plans, and Policy. He also served as a panel member for the recent Army Science Board study, which focused on the Army's ability to operate in a nuclear environment. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. A privilege to be here. Thank you very much.
Sir, I first want to talk about your background and how you got involved with nuclear operations. I read that you're an armor officer by trade, and then you turned into a strategist. So where did you get your passion for nuclear operations?
Thanks for the question. I grew up, I'm one of the last officers probably in my cohort, my generation, who grew up during the Cold War. So weapons of mass destruction writ large, but particularly nuclear weapons, were a part of my upbringing as a junior officer, as a platoon leader in the 3rd Armored Division, backstopping the Fulda Gap in Germany. And so it was just organic to us to have nuclear operations as part of our training regimen and of our mentality about the range of possibilities of things that could happen to us if we went to conflict. So we had dosimeters in our pocket, and we had whiz wheels that we called them whiz wheels, little paper wheels that we made that had chemical and nuclear effects and would talk to us, inform us about ranges and whatnot. So it was just a part of my upbringing as a tactical combat arms leader. And then as the years grew on and I grew older, and the Army became consumed with coin operations in the Middle East, it became quite apparent about the time I became a senior planner for the Joint Force and several commands, as well as for the Army, that we had lost that expertise. We weren't training it. And as important, we didn't have the intellectual or emotional IQ to even grapple with the problem set. And so it became apparent to me that in one of the topics that I wanted to wrestle with in my final decade of the Army was getting after weapons of mass destruction and trying to improve our readiness, both as a joint force and as a land power. And when you bring up weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons and nuclear operations in particular, you elicit a lot of emotions. It's really strange. It is the only time I've seen people actually cry in a war game. And that happened, and I saw it happen. And it is born of ignorance, not in a pejorative sense, but in just not knowing about nuclear weapons. And I am not an expert, and I don't want to be an expert, but I am an expert at land power, and I'm an Army leader. And so I have an obligation to understand this aspect of warfare. And we have to set aside our emotions. And all of this is to say, I'm not advocating or encouraging the use of nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction. I hope the deterrence holds and they aren't a feature of our future multi-domain operations and large-scale combat operations, but I predict that they will be. And I predict it because our adversaries have these capabilities in large number and different variety. Mm-hmm. And job number one of a planner is to plan against capabilities, not upon intent or wishes or how we want the war to go, but how it could go if the adversary uses the capabilities that they have.
Thanks, sir. I want to first talk about Seaburn. So I know today's podcast is going to be nuclear operations, but that's one of the elements of Seaburn. So chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear. When I was, prepping for this podcast, from a doctrinal standpoint, I went straight to FM311, which is Seaburn operations. And then it was through more conversation that, hey, I need to be talking about ATP 3-72, titled Nuclear Operations. I imagine that's just kind of a small piece of how we lump together Seaburn. And what are some other ways that this simplistic lumping of the threats prove to be an obstacle in the Army?
I certainly applaud anyone who just wants to look at Seaborn. I mean, I would encourage us to look at chemical and biological. I think in the wake of a pandemic, our adversaries are alert to the fact that great mayhem can be achieved, particularly with biological weapons. And if you're an ideologically driven individual or organization, and you just want to destroy, you want to tear down structures and systems and societies, then biological weaponry is a great way to do that. If you don't care about the consequences or you don't care about who you arm, I think the biological threat, like the nuclear threat, is escalating, and we had better pay a lot of attention to it. But for our conversation here, in chemical weapons also, there is a place for bad people and bad organizations to use chemical weapons. But nuclear operations have characteristics that I think make them especially pernicious and inviting to an adversary, a state adversary, which to this point in time, only states have nuclear capabilities. You know, we hope that organizations, you know, terrorist organizations, non-governmental organizations, individuals don't ever have access to the employment of these capabilities, but they could. But for the moment, we're talking about state formal militaries that can employ these capabilities. And so we have to look at them. Chem, bio, and nuclear are different. They are distinct. They have a relationship in terms, they are different than conventional munitions. They are the same that way, but they are absolutely unique in their characteristics, how they're employed, and the consequences of their use. Nuclear operations is the one that I believe we are most likely to see in the future, because nuclear weapons deliver effects to an adversary that are so tempting, namely speed and decisiveness. So it is very, very important to win early in the next war. And I may talk later here, if we have time, a little bit about first battles and winning first battles. Our adversary recognizes that as well, because as you can see in the Ukraine conflict now, if you don't win early, then your only choice is to win long or to negotiate some sort of a settlement, you know, a status quo, wherever the lines of battle have been drawn at that point. So there is an opportunity for an adversary to win decisively and promptly by using a battlefield or a tactical nuclear weapon. And when I talk about nuclear operations, I'm talking about the Army being able to fight, sustain itself in a battle, on a battlefield, with a tactical or operational employment of a nuclear weapon. I'm not talking about the intercontinental exchange of missiles and weaponry at two adversaries' homelands. That is certainly a threat. That is a joint problem. That is a national problem. What I see is more likely is an adversary wishing to isolate a piece of territory, or to destroy a concentration of land power or naval power or air power on the ground, assets of an adversary, and employing nuclear weapons to achieve those effects, to out-escalate, or simply to outmaneuver, and using a nuclear weapon as a maneuver tool to win early in a future battle. And so I think the speed component of nuclear operations, bio is impossible to control, chem is limited. Nuclear, though, I can do a lot of damage in a specific place or places of my choosing with nuclear weapons if I want to do that, because that capability exists. And I think that is a major problem, and I think it's a major temptation for our nuclear armed adversaries who may want to achieve just that kind of outcome in a future battle. So speed to me is really, really, if speed and decisiveness are really the components of nuclear weapons that I think we need to pay attention to, and they differentiate themselves from the other kinds of seaborne threats.
I want to shift over to the 2022 Nuclear Posture Review, and they emphasize three roles of nuclear weapons. The first is to deter strategic attacks. Second, assure allies and partners. And third, achieve U.S. objectives if deterrence fails. So I want to focus on the first role of nuclear weapons, deter strategic attacks. So how do we bolster deterrence?
So whenever the big D word comes out, the deterrence word, it is usually used as a kind of a policy shield. And so what I hear Army officers tell me of all ranks is that is one of two things. Well, first of all, if nuclear weapons are employed, it's not my problem. Are nuclear weapons and thinking about nuclear weapons and preparing for nuclear weapons not my problem? Somebody else's problem. And it's really curious to me that it is the only problem that most Army officers will admit that isn't there. So we always believe, and it's a conviction of mine, that war begins and ends on the ground, that land domain is decisive, and yet we hide behind this deterrence piece as if somebody else, it just all belongs to somebody else. And I don't understand it. It's just irrational. Or the other response I get is that, well, the experts are going to do it. So we're going to have our FA-52s, you know, and the Suburni people, whoever they are, they're going to work on this. They're going to solve this. So it's not really me as a combat arms guy or me as a logistician, not my problem. It's these specialists over here. The people who put on mop suits are going to work on it, which is just, again, it's that's the crazy. I'm not the crazy one. They're the crazy ones because they're denying reality. Right. So deterring strategic attacks, assuring allies, achieving our objectives. The Army does that by being ready to deliver decisive, prompt land power, right? That's how we do it. So we're able to operate in all conditions. We can operate uphill. We can operate downhill. We can operate where the four map sheets come together. We can operate in the rain and the fog and the dark of night. We can operate whatever the threat is, and that includes nuclear operations. That includes if an adversary employs a nuclear weapon, we can still operate. We can fight, we can shoot, we can communicate, we can sustain ourselves, we can evacuate our personnel, we can win the objectives that are assigned to us on the land in the face of a nuclear attack. That is what assures our allies, achieves our objectives. And if we have that capability, the adversary is less likely to ever take that step to begin with. Because it is the reason an adversary will try to exploit this gap in our readiness is because they think we can't respond. We don't know what to do. If they employ a nuclear weapon in a battle or a campaign. So land power readiness is the way that we solve all of those problems. And land power readiness includes operating on a nuclear battlefield.
In the strategy that you signed, the Army's Conventional Nuclear Integration Strategy, there was a quote in there that I feel really relates to what you just said. It says, the degree to which the broader force CNI campaign is successful is when services and combatant commands replace conventional and nuclear warfighting with warfighting.
Yes.
I think that's what you're getting at, is it's not two separate things.
That's right.
It's all warfighting.
Warfighting. And warfighting is done in opposition to the adversary's range of capabilities. So if an adversary has nuclear weapons in their arsenal, and they're of such a capability that they can be employed in the form of a landmine, in the form of a short-range ballistic missile, in the form of an intermediate missile, then we have to be able to fight against that. So nuclear operations are military operations. They're land power operations. They are conventional operations, and we have to be ready for that. So conventional nuclear integration is just that. It is trying to break down these walls that 25 years of coin and the absence of a Cold War we've constructed that. We don't want, as a matter of policy and just morality, we do not want to see the employment of nuclear weapons. And there's a school of thought, I think, that would say, hey, the less we talk about it, the more we make it impossible to even imagine, the less likely it's going to happen. And I think that is doing nothing but creating the likelihood, increasing the likelihood by establishing entrenched vulnerabilities. And I believe an adversary will exploit that eventually. And so I think the pathway to making nuclear operations an operation that doesn't actually happen is to be ready for them and to demonstrate the capability to continue to maneuver in the face of a nuclear employment by an enemy. So all weapons are WMD weapons, all operations are WMD operations. And it is not a distinct category. Again, back in the day, in the Cold War, we just knew that. I can remember spending a day in MOP 4. I can remember changing the track on my tank in MOP 4. And it is excruciatingly painful and difficult. I can remember doing elective decontamination of our vehicles and equipment. And we just knew how to do these things. And we were at least more, I'm not saying that we didn't meet the standard every time, but we were more ready than we are now. And it was just a part of how we plan to maneuver. We have to be ready for it. It has to be a feature in our combined training centers where we do our high-end collector training, just as it has to be at home station training where we do individual tasks that are associated with nuclear operations.
I'm going to go back to those roles of nuclear weapons. So you already talked about deterrence, and the second role is assuring allies and partners. So when it comes to our nuclear posture, how do we assure allies and partners that we are trustworthy and that we are the preferred partner?
We should be planning with them from inception. And this is true for nuclear operations as well as it is for other kinds of operations. You know, there was a article in the Wall Street Journal, front page of the Wall Street Journal, about how European NATO members, their armies have atrophied in terms of their conventional capabilities, tank battalions, infantry vehicles, artillery tubes, etc. And they are our friends in NATO, according to this Wall Street Journal article, are capable of fielding, you know, battalions and brigades, essentially, of these heavy maneuver forces. So you can imagine, you can extrapolate where they are in terms of training to operate in a nuclear environment as partners with us on the battlefield. So we need to help them as we help ourselves. We need to invite them into our training. We need to expose them to what we are relearning about nuclear operations. And we need to plan with them from inception. We overclassify. I don't know. I think it's just instinctive or habitual, or we're just trying to, I don't know exactly what we're trying to protect. But we should be training with them about how weapons could be employed by an adversary. What are the consequences? What does it look like on the ground? We should help them visualize it, and then we should help them establish their own training standards and their own planning annexes to their conventional plans, so that they can pivot to operate with us in a nuclear environment. So, you know, what are they going to do for communications? What are they going to do for medical evacuation? You know, how long, you know, it's education. 90% of this at this stage where we are is education about how long an area will be contaminated. And USANCA is the world class. It is the best organization, field operating army or agency of the headquarters department of the Army, G357. We have the capabilities. We have other commands inside the Army that can help our partners. And so there should, when we do Army staff talks with them, when we do training with them, for instance, we have soldiers rotating to Eastern Europe and Poland right now. Nuclear operations training and maneuver should be a part of the skills that we're sharing with them every single month of the year to build their confidence that they too can stay on the battlefield and win with us.
You've talked about nuclear IQ in other forums. And so this kind of reminds me, we're educating them. We also, you know, need to be educated. So can you talk about what do you mean by nuclear IQ and how do we raise that?
Nuclear IQ is the sum. Nuclear IQ is the sum of what I think we've been discussing here this entire hour. So a couple things that happen in a peacetime army. In a peacetime army, and that's what we are. Now, we're an army that has been waging a lot of contingencies. And in recent years, we've had forces deployed in combat in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But during COIN, the periodicity, the duration of military operations are infrequent. They're violent when they happen, of course, but they're not large scale and they're not persistent. And when you're having that kind of a military deployment process or system for year after year after year, and again, you're just returned to a peacetime status quo, then your ideas and your habits of mind and your priorities shift to institutional matters. And institutional matters for the Army matter. I mean, they're important. Things like recruiting, things like housing, things like pay and benefits, things like healthcare, things like installation governance. I mean, all of these are important to our profession. It's also true that there aren't enough hours in the day to attend just to those. And so people, you just instinctively kind of gravitate to working on those problems. And what is pushed to the side is warfighting. And so instead of spending 90% of our time as leaders on institutional and 5 or 10% on warfighting, maybe it shouldn't be flipped all the way to the other end, but it should be 3/4 of our time or 80% of our time on warfighting, and institutional problems should be the other portion of our day. And we spend, really, if you broke down our schedules and looked at what we're working on, we're just not spending enough time thinking and responding to warfighting issues. Just not. The other thing is that we are a very hyper-compliant officer corps. Hyper-compliant. And we do the things we're told to do as appropriate. But we don't get high marks on creativity, and we don't get high marks on initiative. And so our adversaries are taking advantage and will take advantage of us. I mean, what happened to the Israelis on October 7th is a clear case of a superb army, the Israeli Defense Force, and ourselves and our associated intelligence agencies missing a threat because we were insufficiently creative, because we did not imagine like our adversaries imagined. Because it's not something that we would do. And therefore, we didn't postulate that our adversaries would do such a thing. And we got caught flat-footed, and the result was, unfortunately and tragically, right, the death of many innocent people. And so we have to be more aggressive intellectually so that we can be ready to meet and then surpass and defeat our adversaries on the next battlefield, because they have studied us. And they know what we are capable of, and they know what we are reluctant to do. And nuclear operations is one of those things. And again, I think it increases our vulnerability by being not ready. So our nuclear IQ, part of our nuclear IQ is imagination. Part of our nuclear IQ is education. Part of our nuclear IQ is training. Part of our nuclear IQ is planning. Part of our nuclear IQ is partnering. Overall, it is the elevation of nuclear operations where it should be, as a part of our consideration of multi-domain operations.
As the Army and Army leaders move to increase their nuclear IQ, I think this brings up a conversation on priorities. How do you think commanders should tackle competing priorities in today's environment so that they really can focus on warfighting?
Well, there's no answer and there's no solution. So with each increase in rank and responsibility, your problem becomes more acute. Too much to do, not enough time, everything's a priority. So this is where you, me, every leader, every senior NCO, every officer has to really reflect upon the profession and decide for yourselves what matters. What do you want your soldiers to be ready to do? What do you not want them to be left exposed and unprepared for? And you're going to have to reshape your day. You will not get a lot of help from your chain of command, because everybody has to answer today's mail. What I'm talking about in terms of nuclear IQ, I'm talking about answering tomorrow's mail. I'm talking about what are you doing to get into the future? And the more senior you are, the more sacred and urgent is the obligation that you spend your time in the future. So I would hope that the CAC commander is spending 90% of his time in the future. And I hope the platoon leaders is spending 90% of his time in the present, right? And then the officers can align themselves along that spectrum from second lieutenant to lieutenant general. But the more senior you become, the more you have an obligation to think about what is going to happen when we are at war. Because there won't be time then to do the training that we're talking about. And so doing the community service pieces and, you know, making sure the potholes are filled and the PX is working is all important. It is all important. But is it what's going to keep your soldiers alive? And how much of your time are you going to spend on wartime criticalities, things that are absolutely irreplaceable? And how much of your time are you going to spend on peacetime? How much of your time are you going to spend in the present? And how much of your time are you going to spend in the future? As our officers move through the field grade ranks, I hope that they're increasingly spending time in the future, because that's where you're going to win or lose the first battle. If you don't like long wars, then you better win it early. Because if you fail early, what you get is a long war, right? So we didn't lose in the Pacific in 1942. We got swept out of the entire Pacific. Philippines, Midway, Guam, Wake. I mean, we got hammered, right? And thrown back. But not Midway, all the others, right? And struck in the homeland and struck later in Alaska, right? Those were not defeats because of what happened in 1942. Those were defeats because of what happened in 1939 and 40 and 41, et cetera, right? So we will not win the first battle unless we are getting ready for it right now. And your question's a great one. And I hope that you and your peers wrestle with that a lot. And I hope you do something, you hope you do things differently after you've wrestled with the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are winning or losing that first battle. We are going to be able to prosecute nuclear operations in the future based upon what is happening right now. It'll be too late. It'll be too late once an adversary employs it or even readies their forces to prepare to employ it. We detect that. It'll be too late. So either we're going to win or we're going to lose right now. And in my mind, it is 1937 today. Now, I've been saying that a few years, and I'm glad to be wrong for a couple of minutes. But I feel like we are in the 1930s, and there is large-scale combat operations coming. And I hope that we are across the warfighting functions and across the domains spending a lot of time preparing ourselves.
Sir, I want to kind of talk what's old is new and what's new is old. Despite a significantly different operational environment from 1970s and 1980s, there were critics when we pushed out FM30 that were, hey, you're just dusting off airland battle. So in the same line of thinking, are there critics out there that are also saying, hey, we're just going back to the nuclear posture of the Cold War era? And if so, how do you respond to them?
Good. That's not a criticism. That's an endorsement. I hope they think that. I hope that's what we're doing. And I don't know exactly why that would be a critique. I'd like to hear the argument why that's a bad thing. So what I'm arguing and advocating for here is obviously not a return to Cold War posture or a Cold War. But I am advocating to return to where conventional and nuclear weapons were more tightly integrated, you know, and if I could put a bumper sticker on airland battle, it would be, you know, fight outnumbered and win. And that's kind of the problem we have now, fight outnumbered and win and do it overseas, right? So I think a lot of the strategic operational problems we have are quite similar. And unfortunately, I guess you could say many of our weapon systems, you know, the weapon systems that came online in the 80s are the weapon systems we have now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you think future war is going to be so radically different, and eventually it will be, but in our lifetimes, is it really going to be that radically different? If it is, then tell me, why does Ukraine look like World War I on the Western Front? Nobody is explaining to me why Ukraine and Russia looks like World War I. And this is after decades of investment in all the unmanned aerial systems and all the fancy commo rig and all of the satellites, you know, and all of the gee whiz stuff. And it sure looks like the Somme to me.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? That is the question that people should be asking. And that's where the debate should be. How can it be that all this technology we're employing gets us back to a war that happened 100 years ago? How come October 7th caused such devastation and the subsequent operations in Gaza? Yeah, there's missiles in the air again, and there's a lot of surveillance that is happening. But, you know, that was mostly small arms and conventional weapons. Doesn't look dissimilar at all. Looks like Berlin, 1945, right? Or Hue, right, in the Vietnam War. Why is that? Is technology going to really differentiate future war that much? I mean, at some point, perhaps so. Perhaps so. But when it comes to the tactical operation, when it comes to battles, and even into the operational echelon, I think a hard look at the past is the best way to get ready for the future. And to the extent, you know, multi-domain operations as we build it out is not airland battle. And there were things in airland battle that we never quite solved. I mean, we never quite solved the sustainment piece. And It was going to be hard to operate in a nuclear contaminated environment. It, very, very difficult, just as it will be in the future. So there were pieces that we didn't get quite right. We still had long timelines to get forces over it. And it had its problems. But if we're returning to something like that with the addition of the other domains and how cyber and space, you know, are going to play in the new technologies and the speed. When the Chief of Staff of the Army, General McConville, wrote his multi-domain operations white paper 3 and a half years ago, you know, the big ideas were speed, range, and convergence. And we could add lethality, I think, to that. But those are pretty good ideas. And, you know, I hope the doctrine writers are paying attention to that. And to the extent that, you know, MDO is an upgunned, upranged, more technically integrated air-land battle, I don't think that's a bad thing. So I'll take that criticism, you know, all day long and flip it back and see what the critics have to say about it. Because as long as we're being intellectually brave and curious and we're demonstrating a lot of intellectual initiative, we're going to come up with a better system. We can call it multi-domain operations. We can call it something else. But the fundamental truths on the ground, I don't think are going to change that much in our lifetimes.
Yes, sir. Sir, you've already talked to, you know, Russia and Ukraine. In the 2022 Nuclear Posture Review, it pointed out that Russia thinks very differently about nuclear operations than we do in the United States. The NPR states that Russian doctrine covers the employment of nuclear weapons in situations other than all-out war and regularly trains and exercises employment of these weapons at all echelons. So, like I said, you've already kind of talked about Ukraine, Russia. Are there any more things that we have learned from how the Russians think and maybe about ourselves that you can provide insights onto?
I think it's fascinating that the Nuclear Posture Review makes that statement, and yet Army leaders are reluctant to act upon it. I mean, it's very clear what Russian doctrine says, and we know they have so we can cite their doctrine, and we know what their arsenals are, and we know they have these capabilities that are suitable for different echelons of employment. And yet we wrestle with ourselves about whether we really want to do this. I mean, it's just a classic case of, you know, I just don't want to do the stuff that I need to do to get ready for the event. I mean, a lot of it just comes down to that. I'm really busy. It's really hard to do large scale combat operations. I just want to offload this nuclear piece because it's just painful and I don't want to think about it. I don't want to do it. And therefore I'm going to rationalize that I don't need to. I mean, that's a lot of it. That's a lot. It's like, I often tell people that land power, and it's especially true of nuclear operations, it's like selling and then eating vegetables. We all know we should eat our vegetables. We know that vegetables are good for us. We know we need them every day. And yet there's always a reason, right, to go have dessert. I mean, it's just that simple. We just don't want to do it in the face of what our adversaries are throwing up at us. I mean, we have the challenge of being ready to fight large-scale war, which is a terrible outcome, in a time when our society overall, I mean, you know, we want to make and spend money. We want to be prosperous and safe and happy and healthy. All the things, right, that our values and then our systems produce. And we want other people around the world to have the same opportunities and benefits. And yet there are some actors who are absolutely blood and soil people. Right, they crave territory. Right? They crave, an ethnic assimilation, or they have a religious ideology that they want to pursue and to force upon others. And so, in the face of these blood and soil kind of adversaries, it is just our obligation as Army leaders to be ready to defend the nation and our allies and partners against those threats, as uncomfortable as the weaponry, as uncomfortable as the domain may be for us. And, you know, I believe war is about compellence. At the end of the day, I have to convince an adversary that they are defeated. And unfortunately, compellence often requires a lot of killing. And nuclear weapons can kill a lot of people. So there's a bunch of reasons that nuclear weapons are attractive to bad actors and are ability to keep them deterred from using those weapons is predicated, at least in major part, upon our readiness to withstand the punch that they throw at us. Because if they throw a nuclear punch at us and we continue to maneuver, we continue to dominate on the land, along with our naval and our air partners, then it becomes less enticing. It becomes less of a quick lunge that they can make for an outcome. And they recognize that if they do that, the consequences of them will be severe and prolonged, and that they won't win with that. So it just, for all of these reasons, moral and practical and institutional, it is just important that we act upon what we already know, that our adversaries have the doctrine, they have the capabilities. All they lack is the opportunity and the decision to do so.
That's all the questions that I have for you today. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know or to think about?
Hey, thanks, Colonel Becker. This was a fun conversation. Not fun. It's not a fun conversation, but it's an engaging conversation, and it's an important one. So I commend you and the leadership there for taking this on and being willing to listen to me. And I want to applaud the rest of the doctrine writers there at Combined Arms Center that I know are working on these topics as well. Hats off to USANCA and the work that they're doing. I would encourage everyone to contact USANCA if you have an appetite for greater education and training guidance as to what they can do for you. There's really just no limit there. There's the world's best, the Joint Force's best on this. And I'll sum up where I started, which is, you know, our job, we want to deter war, prevent war. But if it comes to war, we have to win it. And the sooner we win it, the less the damage and destruction and casualties that we'll suffer. So I would just encourage us all to think deeply. You know, I'm not asking everyone to agree with me. I'm asking everybody to consider what we've talked about today and to make it a part of their, you know, warfighting approach and to spend a lot of time on warfighting. We'll collectively get better. Just imagine if we did warfighting like we used to do I don't even know if the Army does Motor Stable Mondays anymore, but just imagine if we spent an entire day on warfighting every single week, or 2 days or 3 days, how good we could become. And we've got the best leaders, the best non-commissioned officers, soldiers and officers and civilians in the Army, in the world, in our Army. And it's all up to us. It's all inside our heads and hearts as to whether we get ready. I hope I'm wrong that it's not like 1937, but if I'm right, that we've got a lot of work to do in a pretty short period of time. And I hope this conversation contributes to that. So thanks very much for listening and for engaging. You asked some great questions, and I wish you all the best. Go Army.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by Captain Wyatt Harper in 29 Pixel Studios. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at US Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the US Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.